Blog Talk Radio.
I stroll through the pictures, what I've left behind. It wants again. I'm locked up in memories, they all intertwine. The memories in my mind. I know tomorrow, 'cause that dawn will come. You will never know just what you have done.
Well, good evening, everyone, and welcome to the Stop Child Abuse Now Talk Radio Show, sponsored by NASCA, which stands for the National Association of Adult Survivors of Child Abuse. Today is Monday, April 12, 2021. We are on the 12th day of April, which is also the 12th day of Sexual Assault and Child Abuse Prevention Awareness Month. It's a very important month in our book. Every day is a reason to be aware of these two very, very important issues. With me on my host team this evening is Pamela Lockridge from NASCA. She's also our show's producer. She's ambassador for NASCA and also on the board. So I'm excited to be hosting tonight with Pamela. And tonight is a special guest night. That's the type of show we're having tonight. And we have a very special guest this evening, and as you know, all of our guests are very special guests. That's how I introduce everyone. There's no favoritism at NASCA. But I am very, very pleased to introduce you in a moment to Mike Tikkanen from Tucannon. I may be pronouncing his last name incorrectly. He's from Hopkins, Minnesota. But before I tell you a little bit more about Mike, I wanted to talk to you about NASCA and its mission statement. NASCA is all about child abuse, trauma prevention, intervention, and recovery. So if you'd like to participate in the show this evening or any evening by being a panelist, it's very easy. All you have to do is call in. The number is area code 646-595-2118. Again, that number is area code 646-595-2118. And Pamela will have a side conversation that's not be heard live on the air to introduce you into the show. And you'll have an opportunity when we break in the different segments of the show to ask our special guest a question or offer a comment related to our special guest and his story. So again, if you'd like to call in, even if it's your first time, we will take care of you. The number is 646-595-2118. So I'd like to first introduce our panel members. We have a very robust panel this evening, and we do appreciate our panel members calling in and supporting our guests. Of course, myself, Penelope Bennett from Bellevue, Washington. We have Pamela Lockridge from Louisiana. We have Peter from Ontario, Canada. So we are an international organization, and we do have callers and panelists that call in from other countries and other continents. We have our special guest, Mike, and we have Bill, our founder of NASCA, Bill Murray. So welcome, Bill, and everyone. Thank you for calling in. So before I mute on live, I want to talk to you a little bit about Mike. He is from Hopkins, Minnesota, and he is a returning NASCA family member. He is absolutely perfect for appearing in April, which is Child Abuse Awareness and Prevention Month. He is all about, his mission is working on prevention intervention in his home state of Minnesota. He's the founder and president of Kids at Risk Action, which is abbreviated CARA, K-A-R-A. It's a nonprofit action tank that supports the people, policies, and programs that improve the lives of at-risk children. Mike knows all too well the statistics of child abuse. There's much more that I could share with you about Mike. He provides a lot of information, but this is his show, and I will allow you to hear what he is doing in his story directly from him. So without further ado, Mike, I am going to bring you on live and welcome you this evening. Welcome, Mike. Thank you for joining us.
It's great to be here. Thank you for having me. It's been a while. I'll give a little background to Kids at Risk Action. We, a few guardian ad litems, court-appointed special advocates, got together back in the late 90s and decided to advocate for the kids that we were advocating for in the courtroom. And over the years, we've written books and done a lot of public speaking, built a pretty good social media following, and tried really hard to bring more public attention to the issues. If you have questions specifically, I will try to answer them. But
so yes, thank you for that. So you know, typically on special guest night, we have sort of a format to these shows, which I didn't mention in our introduction this evening. I wasn't sure if it was relevant or not. But because we archive these shows and so many of our NASCA family members or other adults that are, you know, struggling with the effects of childhood abuse, that they like to actually see archived shows and listen to them. So we have a structure for them, and they do go chronologically just so there's some consistency in the shows and how they kind of move through a story from beginning of life, you know, to present time. So the reason I'm giving you that background is I don't know if you are an adult survivor of child abuse or if you just got involved in this line of work. So if you wouldn't mind, you know, giving us some background, how, you know, you became involved in the line of work and do what you do just for some context, I think that would be really helpful.
You bet. No, I appreciate that. In 1996, I became a volunteer guardian ad litem in the courts for at-risk children. I was active for 12 years. I'm still on the board of CASA Minnesota. Some of the kids stuck with me for a few years after that. I've removed about 50 children from really sad, dangerous home lives. It's become a larger part of my life every year since then, really. And now we have a few staff members. And on a second book, recognizing that the COVID pandemic has locked children into homes without access to mandated reporters, and we believe that that things are worse now than they were when we started. There's a lot of kind and gentle people trying to make things better, but it's going to be really hard now. The institutions themselves are being really stressed because the old punishment model is still with us, and I can talk a little bit about those things. Is that enough of a beginning, or are there specific things you would maybe like to add?
Oh, yes. No, that's really helpful. So you, this was your line of work that you became involved with. And if you have a personal story, whether or not you wish to share it is completely up to you. I just wasn't sure if it was, you know, born of your own experience or, you know, where sort of the inception of your work or where it originated started from.
As a practical matter, it began as a volunteer, and it still is as a volunteer effort to bring attention to the kids that we've worked with in the Guardian Ad Litem program as volunteers. That's where I come from. I'm a businessman. I used to own a junkyard. I've manufactured garments, done a bunch of things as an entrepreneur. Had a rough childhood, actually, but it had mostly to do with alcohol and my own misbehavior. So I'm extremely grateful to be where I am now, and working with the children, the youth that I have worked with. It saddens me that we as a people, as a culture, as a community, have been so tight, so unwilling to make the efforts that have been needed, that these kids need to have. Now with the ACEs healing models coming out, and it's so obvious that the punishment model that we've used in our schools and our policing, you know, just as parenting even, you know, parenting traumatized kids as foster parents is a very difficult mm-hmm. thing. I tell a sidebar about that with a board member who just passed away last year, David Strand, did made public policy in Europe on children's issues for 10 years. And when he came home, he was so distraught at what he saw as to how at-risk children were treated. He became a guardian ad litem and wrote a PhD thesis at university articulating the difference between how the rest of the industrialized world treated its children compared to how America treats its children. And that book became part of the one that I wrote. And, you know, I still use the data. And as a matter of fact, I'm going to make a plea for information and data for our second, for our next book, because it's really changing now, and not for the better as far as the numbers and the seriousness. I just share a few little things. Pre-COVID, 37% of American youth were being reported to Child Protective Services in this nation by their 18th birthday. 80% of the youth aging out of foster care were leading dysfunctional lives. One more, and I won't do this to you too often because people hate data, but our 9-year recidivism rates in the prisons are reaching 90%. And my favorite, I shouldn't say it like that, but the strongest quote I can give you is from our Chief Justice, Minnesota Supreme Court Chief Justice Kathleen Blatz, who made the comment that 90% of the youth in the juvenile justice system have passed through child protection. It takes extraordinary something, usually an adult in one's life, if you're a traumatized child, an abused child, to get to the other side without being so badly damaged and unhelped that you don't end up somehow in a justice system or a preteen, teenage mom. Mm-hmm. So our whole being as Kids at Risk Action is to try to tell the larger story, the story that affects every teacher, every law enforcement officer, every social worker, every foster and adoptive parent, and everybody that really has interaction with traumatized kids that have not got the help they needed, that didn't get to find the way. Because it's not easy. There's no book that comes with being 5, 6, or 7 that says these things that happened to you were wrong, they were against the law, it's not your fault. And the behavior problems that come with trauma are the behavior problems that come with trauma. It's a biological reality that a certain part of the brain starts to try to save you, and it takes years of self-training and help from others to find a way to lead a happy life, a functional life. And I'm just still amazed at how slow we are to end a punishment model that really doesn't work, has never worked on these youth. You know, we expel kids from daycare. We expel kids from grade school. We expel kids from junior high and high school. Kids that we know, if they don't learn how to read, if they don't get through school, if the things don't go at least until high school, that their chances of living a productive life and having a good life are very, very slim. Again, back to data, which I won't do to you again, but the data is terrible, and it's been terrible for many, many years. And the only way it's going to get better is if more of us talk about these things to more people and actually ground ourselves in the realities that our nation now faces. And you can see it everywhere. I live in Minneapolis where, you know, they burned a big part of our city down with the George Floyd murder.
Mm-hmm.
And really, there's just a lot of unhappy and angry people. And I'm I don't throw rocks at the people doing the work. It's hard work. They haven't been trained well enough in the ways that do work, could work, and the resources have been slim. Now, the good news, and there is good news, is that the new advances in medical, telemed in particular, but artificial intelligence, I'll tell you about a program that we're working with that provides for $12 a month. Now, it's a test program, and I can't sell it here yet now, but we're starting in May with an organization that works with troubled youth to give them an app on their phone. It's an artificial intelligence that learns all about them on the way in. They're assigned a telephone coach. And if they have issues that can't be resolved by and the AI is amazing. I won't try and describe it other than to say that artificial intelligence is a real thing. I mean, they're putting things on Mars with it so we can deal with human beings, you know. And $12 a month. I'm looking at that as something where for 20, 25 years, I've tried to find mental health services for the kids that I work with because they needed help. They needed help. It's troublesome. And the approach that we've used has really always been ineffective at best. And I'm so familiar with Prozac, Ritalin, and Zoloft and the psychotropic medications and the way that really, they don't solve anything. They keep people from hurting themselves sometimes and hurting others. You know, that's why they're used, I believe. But the suicidal ideation message on every package that you'll buy at any time anywhere is very, very real. And if people don't understand what that means, and suicidal ideations, it's indescribable, really. It's fully formed thoughts of killing yourself just being dropped into your head, and there's nothing you can do about it. And youth, who have no grounding in mental health, no understanding of these monstrous concepts. It hurts me. You know, I sometimes chuckle when I, you know, I mean, it's instead of crying, because I can look at those kids, and I flew a kid up to a couple hours out of the city, no suicide beds here, and they put me on a plane with them. And, you know, it's a sixth try. I think it was 12. And, you know, I see it. I see it in young kids. And right now, actually, I just finished an article where I quoted a single hospital in Texas that had 43 suicide attempts last month by youth. And pandemic is locking kids into these homes. They don't have access to mandated reporters. There's a lot of alcohol and drug use. And, you know, the parents, it's hard. It's hard. It's hard for everybody. And we now live in a place where, you know, we haven't respected young couples, poor people enough to say you need a living wage. You need health insurance. You need access to telemed, you know.
Oh, I agree.
It breaks my heart.
I agree. Well, I don't. I don't mean to interrupt. And I do not mean to interrupt you, but you've given us so much. We're already, you know, into the first 20 minutes of the show, and wow. I mean, before I break to the panel, all I can say, and actually bring in my co-host Pamela as well, before we break to the panel, all I can say is I wish we could duplicate you and clone you so many times over, because you've just, you know, what you just articulated is, and I know there were a lot of other people that are listening in, either on the panel or listening in by streaming, that are probably just nodding their heads. You know, I can so resonate with everything you just said. And a couple things really struck me. The first is, I just went to a political fundraiser with my husband. So, of course, I bring my NASCA card. You know, I have a card about my involvement with NASCA and about my position and what NASCA is all about. So I took the opportunity to introduce myself to this candidate. He's already a council member, so he's running for re-election. So I talked to him about NASCA. And his response was, well, we've seen the rates, you know, the call-ins, the CPS, they're declining. I just looked at him and I said, well, of course they are. You know, kids are still in remote school. They haven't been in school for a year. A lot of mandatory reporters are not seeing them. So if the mindset of, you know, those that run our communities is that things are getting better. That is a problem. They're not getting wetter, getting better, to your point. They're getting worse. These kids are not being seen by the mandatory reporters, not to mention the pediatricians that are doing virtual or telephone appointments. So that's the first thing that you stated is, this is a global pandemic that is absolutely getting worse. And the other thing I just wanted to make a comment on was just regarding everything that you're doing in terms of the awareness and also the, you know, resources for everyone, including these children that you're seeing that you work with. We have so much work to do. I posted on my personal Facebook page the fact that it was April's Child Abuse Prevention Month and that I have about 200 blue ribbons to wear in acknowledgement of the month and of child abuse prevention and awareness. And anyone who wants a few ribbons, IM me, I'll ship them to you. No one responded to that, and only 5 people that I'm friends with out of 700 acknowledged my post, and it was public. That tells me as well, to your point, we have so much work to do. So
go ahead.
No. Yeah, no, please make a remark, and then I do want to invite Pamela to join us, my co-host. But I didn't mean to cut you off in the remark, so.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I do want to draw attention to what Kids at Risk Action thinks is just a monstrous problem with the thing that we're speaking about. And it's twofold, really. One is that institutions don't find it works in their favor to be too transparent. And I could get into the weeds with you and tell you just how tough that is. I mean, it's very true. There's some things that are shared, but many that are just never shared. And it's so important. There's no other institution. I'm kind of committed to CPS because I've been through that so long on the working side. But I know that that's a huge failure. And because of that, because we don't know the results of the foster care system, the results of psychotropic, you know, how many kids in the system in the community you live in, do you know they have a good foster home? Do you know if they're on psychotropics? Do you know if they're tied up in the juvenile justice? Do you know? And we really don't. We get bits and pieces of data from justice, from courts, but the media itself, it's a huge problem with this because reason one is advertisers don't want to be seen around it. It's one of those subjects that advertisers don't cozy up to. So they're not really chasing the topic. And because the public does not know, and this is core, because the public does not know, they don't call their legislators. And when you go to the state house to get things done, you know, it's full of people with money that are demanding things from legislators. And so the media doesn't pick up what it can't get its hands on to report on, which it might do if it could. And even in the case of child death, and that's on our website, we interviewed the journalist that did a huge one-year-long project on a four-year-old boy that was tortured to death by his mother. And, you know, he had to fight with the rural county to get and the boy was dead, and there was just no reason to not give him the information. Freedom of Information Act and $10, $15 a page for copied material. So it is really up to us that do know, you know, to make sure that the people around us know, and whether it's calling the paper, writing op-eds, or calling state legislators, these kids don't have a voice. And that's what makes Kids at Risk Action so nuts, is that, you know, we see these little bits and pieces around, and to be able to put them into this book that we're working on, it's a big undertaking, and tie them together so that we can hand them to the people that are making the decisions, the legislators, administrators, the people that would make a difference if they only knew. That's our hope, because we don't think people are by nature all mean and hateful. We don't think that. We think that it's a complex set of issues, and that the thing we just talked about, people not answering your Facebook, people are clueless in general. They don't know. We use words like maltreatment instead of child rape. There's a lot of reasons people don't understand. Obfuscation, euphemism, it's an uncomfortable subject. But we have to make people understand one way or the other. And until that happens, these prisons will be full and the schools will be broken and our streets will be full of sadness. Anyway, I'm sorry to go on.
Do not apologize. Do not apologize, because this is your work and your passion, and we are right there with you. But Pamela, thank you for joining me. Thank you, and good evening. How are you?
I'm fine. How are you, Penelope?
Good. I'm fine.
And hello to everybody else on the panel, and our special guest, Mr. Mike, and I'm not sure how to pronounce the last name, so can
you just
Mr. Mike?
Yeah. Yeah,
okay.
That's fine. Yeah, let's do that. But you did a nice job on the way in. It was just fine. Yeah.
Well, I was reading some research, and it said something about you had done something or spoke to the UN, and, you know, there's the Human Rights Watch, and you know, they're supposed to be watching over all the countries that are, you know, mistreating children, right? Because, like you said, children don't have a voice. So I think it's going to end up coming down to, and I'd like to know your thoughts on this, that, you know, if we don't get a handle on it in our country, which is supposed to be the leader, you know, of other countries, they're supposed to look at us and say, yeah, they're doing a good job, let's go like they are, that we're going to have the UN step in eventually and, you know, come against our country with human rights against our children. I'd like to know what you think about that.
Yeah, I would like to address that. That's very near and dear to my heart. The United States of America is the only nation in the world, 200 nations in the world, I think. We have not ratified the United Nations Rights of the Child Treaty of the 1980s. It was originally written, proposed by President Hoover in the 20s. And so if you, children have the same rights as women had pre-1918. They are chattel. And people don't like it when I talk about it, but by God, it's important. They don't have rights. They have what's called the imminent harm doctrine in this country, which means that in the circumstances where a child might die, a judge can take, you know, when the life is threatened, a judge can take a child out of a home. And I realize there's a lot to unpack here, because it gets into parent rights and it gets into religion and it gets into a lot of things. But the underlying issue really is that children have no rights. And I've actually been in a classroom where social workers talked about how they rode in the car behind the car that went to a home because of an animal problem where somebody beat their dog to death. To get into the homes is hard. And here I'm getting a little far. It sounds far afield, but it's not. Social workers, it takes a lot in some communities to do the visits, and since children really don't have any rights, they don't hire a lawyer. The court appoints an advocate for them. But when you get into what does that really mean, and it varies a little bit from state to state and county to county. 3,000 counties do interpret these things all very differently. But underlying it all is that the American kids have, you know, we haven't ratified the Rights of Child Treaty. And technically, they can't speak for themselves. And the system's been overwhelmed for so long that, and that people are doing what they can with what they have as the workers are, whether they're social workers or, you know, people involved in juvenile justice, all that.
Well,
so
I have
that's my take on the UN. Yeah, sorry.
I have a master's in social work. I haven't worked as a social worker or a child welfare social worker. But, you know, I was sexually abused from the age of 4 to 18 by my mother's second husband, and she actually knew he was doing this to me, and pretty much basically I was pimped out to him, you know, trafficked. And so, you know, I was trafficked back in the 60s when we didn't even have that term on the radar. But my other question, and I like to ask these questions outside the box because, you know, if we don't get a handle on what's going on with our children, our society is going to implode within. You know, we're not going to have children that go to school, become nurses, become doctors, become professionals. They're all going to be abused. I mean, at the rate we're going in some form or fashion. That I wanted to ask was, do you think that what we're going to have to go to is that we're going to have to just assume children are being, you know, molested or beaten and try to have some kind of screening for each child in the future?
That's really a wonderful thought, and it has to happen. The two parts that I've heard are on the table now. One are in grade school as children come into school, because that's really, you know, if we were set up for it, that's where everything could get fixed. It really would be. The ACEs healing model, and you know, I've been in a grade school where they threw the principal out because he was using the ACEs healing model. 5 years ago, a little ahead of its time, and sadness to me, great sadness. He was a wonderful man doing the right thing, and there was political people in there that loved the punishment model, and if you didn't punish those children, something was terribly wrong with what you were doing. So grade schools and screening is huge. The ACEs healing model, the ability to get in and find out what children need, what kind of help. And I'd like to point out that generational child abuse is really on fire in America, has been for quite a while now, and because we didn't do what we could have done to stop it or slow it down. And what that means is that parents can only raise their children the way they were raised. And so
Absolutely.
The family size has grown in child protection, and the numbers are huge. And the things you said to start with about what's happening to us as a people is really, truly what's happening to us as a people. The mental health issues, I started to talk about criminal justice, juvenile justice, but the numbers are amazing. We've been overstuffing our prisons for years. I could go on and all the terrible things that happened with that and recidivism. And 2/3 of the kids in juvenile justice have mental health, diagnosable mental health issues. Half of them are severe, chronic, and dangerous in many cases. So the numbers, the severity of it, yes, you're dead right.
Okay. Thank you. I'll let other panelists talk. I do have more questions and comments, but I can't take up all the time. So thank you, Mr. Mike.
Thank you.
Thanks, Pamela. And I'm going to bring on Bill Murray.
Hi, guys.
Welcome.
Thank you. Mike T, you can call him, but it's Tickenham. I call him Mike Tickenham.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mike, I'm really grateful to have you on. I'm glad we could find a slot for you in April because this is, as you well know, Child Abuse Awareness Month, and you are all about prevention and intervention, which are a really essential portion that doesn't get enough attention. Well, it's all about that for you. Kids at Risk Action and Invisible Children are dedicated to, you know, to a variety of policies and programs that support getting the message out to the community about how bad the problem is and what we can do about it. So I like the discussion you're having about teaching kids. We need to teach them in grades. We need to teach them all through school, frankly. But kindergarten or early school, maybe first grade and second, and then later in college, I think are two and as a freshman in college too, because they're kind of there are prisoners at that point. You know, they're brand new to it and they're eager to do their stuff and not prisoners, but what's the word I'm looking for? They're open to be told messages that later they won't be. Like a kid in grade school gets jaded eventually, and a kid in college, the same thing happens. But when they're a freshman in college coming into the system, you can reach them then, and you can invite them if they've been abused to seek recovery. And the same thing is true of kids in early education, kindergarten and first grade and second grade. You can teach them and their parents, perhaps, in a way that you can't later in grade school. So anyway, there's an awful lot, ladies, for Mike to talk about here. So, and he's willing to. And by the way, he's not a survivor, but he's interested in survivorship too, of course. And he actually asked me recently for some ideas about how a survivor can start a group, a recovery group. So I've actually included that in the description for Mike's show tonight, with a link that takes you to a page, anybody can go there, where there's about six or seven different styles of groups that we suggest, and we don't prefer one over another, but whatever appeals to you, you could pursue and start your own group in your own area. So there you go. All right, I'll be quiet, like Pam, taking the lead from Pamela, because I can talk all night too, Mike. But I'm glad you're here.
Thank you, Bill, as always. And I'm going to now bring on Peter from Ontario, Canada. G'day, Peter. You're on with Mike.
G'day, Penelope, Pamela, Bill, and everybody. And g'day, Mike. I'm going to be honest. I don't have any questions to ask. I'm trying to soak all the information that you're sharing this evening. It's just a little too much for me to try and grasp. So if you don't mind, I'm going to try and just sit in and listen in to your talk, if that's all right.
No problem at all. Thank you, Peter, and thank you for calling in and being on the panel this evening. I will put you back and listen those, since I know there's a lot more to come. And I'm going to bring on Darlene from Tennessee. She's also an ambassador for NASCA. And Darlene, good evening. You're on with Mike.
Good evening. Hello, Mike. Thank you for coming and doing this, being a spokesperson against this. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
And if you got any questions, I would like to help you out if you need any kind of assistance as well. And, we're always learning, you know. So anyway, thank you so much for all that. And it does, you know, abuse happens too often, and it gets scary whenever, now that we're, you know, the ones that we've all been abused, you know, the ones that's been abused, now we can see and look at people, and then we're often wondering, is this person being abused behind that closed door? Is this person? It's like we're having to watch out even a lot more. You know, our radars are constantly out. You know, it's the way it feels like right now, especially during this pandemic.
I am going to ask the listeners to keep an eye out for what they consider important data. If you see things, for instance, the reporting on domestic violence and child abuse, we've alluded to underreporting of child abuse, and it's just impossible to believe. We know it. I still talk to the people that do the work, so we know that rural, there's not a lot of kids even attending school. There's a big number of them that don't have good internet connections. And, you know, with the added fear and stress of both the pandemic itself and poverty and all the things that come with that in a struggling family, there is going to be information showing up in local news, different states. I do cover the country as far as reporting goes, and the book itself is going to point out which states are doing the best and which states are doing the worst. And that has to do, you have to know, you know, to make those claims, you have to know, like the data piece that I gave you about, I guess it was Fort Worth, Texas, has one hospital that had 43 youth and child suicide attempts in March, just the last month. That's a lot. I live in Minneapolis, and they have one hospital that gets 1,000 emergency psych visits a month pre-COVID. But again, back to post-COVID, I mean, things are, you know, we don't measure them to start with. You see these bits of information show up, and we need to know the source and all that, but hopefully the contact information Bill has included, you can get a hold of us, and or Mike at invisiblechildren.org. And again, I am gathering that. It's going to take us a while. We've got a publication date of we're shooting for December or January, so it's a ways off. But it's important for us to be able to find those data points that, you know, you look at in the paper and you think, oh, that can't be true. But it is. And, you know, in many communities, they're really, really struggling to keep up with the pain that's being caused by this. And hopefully, if more of us talk about it and it becomes more of a conversation, then the media maybe will help us get this word out, because until the general public knows more, I'm not optimistic. It's been a long, hard row, 25 years now, and we have to be more organized, and we have to just make people understand that if they don't help us with the crisis nurseries, if they don't support the things, hopefully this new administration has money now, so that the programs that we're in need of, we're going to start to see, but we're so far behind in having them. Quality daycare, you know, the things that help young families through times like this, because as Bill mentioned too, you know, we're talking about not just taking the child out of the home, but if we can help a struggling family to overcome a meth problem or an alcohol problem. And we don't like taking children out of the home, but as a practical matter, we have to, because leaving them in those circumstances is just, it's something you can't do. And if you live through that, you know, as someone that's involved in the work, you realize the kids deserve better. And we as a people need to recognize and stand for them and speak for them.
We're their voice.
Yeah.
That's right. Well, thank you, Darlene. Thank you. And I think we'll have one more chance to come back to the panel. So I'm going to put you back on mute. And there is so much to cover. And to Bill's point, and you've done and are doing so much. So to continue on with what Bill had mentioned, and in the bio, it's mentioned that Mikey recently worked on a local PSA project and asked us at NASCA for ideas on how a survivor can start a recovery group. So do you want to maybe expand on that a little bit? And how that played out with starting a recovery group, or how one can actually go about doing that?
We were contacted by an organization that's working with somebody that showed an interest in starting a recovery group in Minnesota. And I have reached out to a few people. We're stretched thin at Kids at Risk Action, really, with 1.5 employees and a few volunteers. to take it on. So I had hoped that we could find another person. And I earlier today I spoke with somebody that that might be a candidate to get involved. But I am waiting for that person to show up that I can't do it myself. I'm going to need to have somebody else take the 4, 5, 6, 7 hours a week, whatever this is, to shepherd it. So that is one of the, you know, my staff gets really mad at me when I start saying yes to people without talking to them. And I feel sorry for them, and I try not to do that anymore. Yeah.
Well, I mean, it obviously is a village, and I'm just going to actually make a shout out to anybody that's listening or anybody that will stream this in the future from an archive and listen. If you wish to start a recovery group or you have a question about a recovery group for adult survivors of child abuse, please visit www.nasca.org. And again, NASCA is NAASDA.org. Go to the contact list. Any of us on the contact list would be happy to help you and point you in the right direction and give you the resources to start a recovery group in your area. If you wish to join a recovery group, NASCA does have Zoom recovery group meetings for its members, and all you have to do to be a member of NASCA is want to be one, and you are one. The information's on our website. They are Tuesdays, Thursdays, and Sundays at 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. All are welcome. They're very, very well facilitated by survivors and survivor professionals. So I did want to put that in there. Whether you wish to start one or just get involved with one, for your graciousness and allowing me to share that with our listeners. I also, in your bio, you have a book. And you mentioned this, Invisible Children, Preteen Mothers, Adolescent Felons, and What We Can Do About It. It's an uncomfortably close look at the American cycle of abuse and its cost. The need for civic involvement of young future community leaders is a solution to America's at-risk youth problem. So without today's college students' understanding and support, schools will continue to fail, streets to be unsafe, and jails to fill. So I will turn, you know, the mic back over to you, but I did want to give our listeners a little bit and our panel members a little bit more of what your book and what you're working on. But I'll turn it back over to you, Mike.
Yeah, the first book was written in 2005, and it was a product of about 10 years of being in child protection as a guardian litem. And the book is the story of the children that I worked with. And, you know, Minnesota's a fairly wealthy state, and if it can't do it right, you know, there's so many states that have really done a bad job. And I have so much information from data to videos to, you know, it makes me angry. And so the book itself was just that. It was a combination of David Strand's work in Europe, that statistical analysis of, you know, the success that they have. They've treated, after the Second World War, Europe realized if they didn't rebuild, they could rebuild their buildings. You know, they were devastated, but rebuilding the families was more important. And they did that. That's where that social safety net came from. They helped their young families become healthy, productive members of society. And when David wrote his book, it became so utterly clear that really was the heart of the matter. We built, instead of a healing society, we built a punishment society. And you're seeing it now with the racism and the sadness that really kind of tagged along. I mean, we've been both punishment-oriented and a racist nation for a long, long time. And when I talk about expelling kids from daycare, well, we're the only nation in the world that does that. Our kids are troubled. They're really troubled. And we expel kids from grade school. And you can't do that. if you're going to expect that child to have any kind of a life. And part of what I'm doing that's very complicated is trying to make people understand the economic costs of not taking care of other people's children. Because when you don't do that, they grow up and join a gang, or they're preteen moms, or there are things that just, they never quit costing you money. And so our tax dollars would be much more wisely invested in crisis nurseries, subsidized daycare, quality foster care, just 100 other places you could put that money that would break the back of generational child abuse. Because then once those children are healed and well and living happy lives, they go on to have families that are healed and well and live happy lives. So it's not rocket science. We've done the dumbest things and the meanest, and it's not pleasant for the cop. It's not pleasant for the social worker. It's not pleasant for the teacher. I don't know how many educators you know, but I talk to them and they tell me what it's like to spend 70-80% of your time in a classroom keeping one kid from hurting other people or hurting him or herself. You know, the same holds true really with the police. They are stuck with managing mental health problems of 12, 15-year-old kids. And a personal story that I tell when I say that is that the last time I cried spontaneously was when a boy who had been with me for a long time, and he was 7 when I met him, and he was about 12 when he got out of the car, and he told me he was going to suicide by cop that day. It was on his list. And that's the kid I was telling you about that I flew up to northern Minnesota. And I just, you know, I mean, it just, you can't live with that. It's secondary trauma is real. So for us as a people to be so uncaring about, I shouldn't say it like that, but I mean, legislatively, they are bombarded by, you know, we're the most capitalist nation in the world, and I love it too. I used to own businesses and do things and make money, but I never did. You get on the other side of this, you realize that you don't want to do it in a heartless way. We all have a vested interest in other people's kids, and being kind and sweet and healing instead of just this giant build all these prisons and jails, and we can't punish people enough. You know, you can't punish a traumatized kid. I learned that a long time ago. I'm a very terrible disciplinarian because it has never worked on the kids I worked with in child protection. I just worked really, really hard to get them to trust me. And when that worked, then I had something. And they felt better and I felt better. But trying to discipline, and believe me, you put a blue uniform on somebody and give them a gun and tell them to take care of those kids, that it never going to work. You're just going to build more jails, more prisons. And putting police into schools is just, oh, my goodness. You know, it's really a hard life that we've chosen for these kids. And so it's up to us to just talk about it and get schooled in the areas that need to be doing more. You know, the ACEs healing model is the best thing to come down the road from the medical community, from any community in 50 years on this. And it could actually, if incorporated into the police departments with de-escalation and the understanding that these are mental health issues and that behavior problems don't always need to be tased and shot. And we shot somebody else in Minneapolis last night. It's just and, you know, the cops are nervous. I know a bunch of them. Their suicide rates, their alcoholism, divorce rates, I mean, they're living in a rough patch, too. I don't envy anybody working with my troubled kids. It's just hard.
But something that really did strike me as an adult survivor of child abuse is building trust. You know, the importance, and just, it's a gift that you give a child who has never had that much experience or had an experience of really truly being able to feel safe and trust somebody in that way. And I believe, I know for me that it wasn't until there was someone that I trust implicitly that I could actually speak of my abuse for the first time and begin to heal. Began to unravel and all the symptoms and the behaviors that accompanied the fact that I was still living my trauma. And so, you know, just yes, in terms of the ACEs, which I completely agree with you on that, by the way, I think every single, you know, state should mandate all of its, you know, healthcare workers to screen for ACEs in children, but as an aside, but that mindset of the, you know, the trust, right, to be that resource, to come at it from that, to come at it from that perspective. You know, children are acting out, especially young children, they act out because they're acting out. There's a symptom. The behavior is a symptom of a problem that's more deep-rooted. And until you can gain the child's trust, you won't get, they won't tell, to your point. And telling is healing, as we all know, as adult survivors of child abuse, from, at least for me, from my own personal experience. But I'm going to invite Pamela to rejoin us because we're at, believe it or not, practically an hour into the show. Mike, the show goes by really fast, 90 seems like a long time, but it does go very, very quickly. So I'm going to invite Pamela back in to join our conversation.
Hi, this is Pamela. Thank you, Penelope. Mr. Mike, as a social worker, and when I was getting my social work degree, I worked as an intern with LAFASA, the Louisiana Foundation Against Sexual Assault. And, of course, you know, as a social worker, we learn in education about child abuse and all those different things. And then there's also, you know, there, in every state, there's a Sexual Assault Foundation. In every state, there's a Domestic Violence. And then there's also the CAC, the Child Advocacy Centers. Now, do you know how long the Child Advocacy Centers have been around? You know, when they started them? Because they were new to me a couple of years ago is when I learned about them.
I think you're right. And to be honest, I'm not positive if that was, if that came out of the legal profession. Because my experience is that, you know, children don't make good, you can't, in court, a child cannot defend herself or himself because the system is set up so that, you know, if you were a child and molested for a long time and you have to speak as your own witness, that, you know, a Harvard Law School lawyer can just tear you apart. So that's, I think that is changing. But it's like ACEs. It's like plumbing. You know, it takes 50 years for things to change in that big way unless a lot of us get out there and talk about needing the change. So I think what the CA, the advocacy centers are doing, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I think it's they're training people how to get testimony from children that'll hold up in court and not do things the way they have always done them before that never worked. And actually, I have a family. I worked with 7 children, and I was in court many, many times over that. And the man that did the abusing of those sexual abuse of those children was never made a party to any court hearing at all. And when I told my supervisor and I told the judge the same thing, that man belonged in prison, I got the same answer. And the answer was, well, would you want to see the child get out of the house or do you want to see her up on a stand and go back home with them? And that's how it was for all those years I was a guardian in Lynham. So I'm really, really happy to see that states are starting to appreciate that children need protection.
Right. The CAC is a multidisciplinary service where the child doesn't get re-victimized over and over by different services, you know, having to deal with them with the same issue over and over. Like Child Protective Service, investigators, law enforcement, prosecutors, medical and mental health professionals. They all work together to just, you know, see the child one time and the child doesn't have to answer over and over and all that stuff. You know, so I don't know. CAC seems pretty cool, you know, but I don't know
you know, the cases have to be brought forward, and that's the problem. You know, so many of the cases are in the house and hidden, you know.
Yeah, but, especially now.
But one more thing I'd like to ask you. How come we don't see more commercials, billboards, newspapers that have big advertisements about child abuse, you know, and how
yeah.
it affects people?
Yeah.
We just don't see it as...
Yeah. We had a law firm put one up in Minneapolis. It was just stunning. Just took your breath away. And it was on the side of buses. But they're expensive. I'd love to explore that. I would. I have a PR firm. I shouldn't, you know, Kara has a PR firm, and we've had a video company make a really powerful 30-second video from one of the major public figures here in town. And I would just, I know that's a great idea. And it should, you know, talk about one of those things I like to just jump into with both feet, because that does wake people up. It's, you know, what do you call it? You know, it makes people think. It makes people
right.
think and talk. And that is really, that's a wonderful thing to talk about. And if you guys have got ideas about that, I'd be more than happy to talk about how to make that sort of thing happen. We came close to doing something like that about 15 years ago with the NFL going to help sponsor something. But you have to have those contacts. And I love that idea. Yeah, it needs to happen.
Thank you, Mr. Mike T.
Well, thank you all.
Thank you.
I enjoyed talking with you.
Yeah, no, thank you, Pamela. So I'm going to bring Bill back on, if I can unmute his mic. My computer is not working very fast. Sorry, everyone.
That's okay. I'm here. Well, a couple things on what was just said. I guess I'll go backwards. I am starting to see some PSAs from legal firms who are actually looking for clients. That's what they're doing. But in the process of doing it, they're saying, you know, if you're a child, if you were victimized by a businessman, a priest, a scouting master, or any other person years ago, and you thought you couldn't get justice, you can now. And it's all about the fact that the statute of limitations has been lifted for a lot of these places, and therefore there's a longer period of time when you can sue. So it's about legal lawsuits, you know, liability. And it's a firm that's been advertising this, promoting this, advertising for them in the last, really very recently, 3 weeks. But I've seen multiple ads in the 3 weeks. So they are serious about doing it. Then I also know that there's some of that going on through email, because I got an email, a series of emails from an organization which I went to years ago asking if they would represent me, and they wouldn't do it back then. Now I'm getting emails, would I mind putting their resource, them as a resource on the NASCA website? Well, I went and looked at the link they sent me, and it was a giant ad. In the body of the ad, it said there's the different kinds of child abuse, and these are some statistics and so forth. It was a big, long, single page, and it probably took you to other places, too. The point is, we don't put ads on, you know, but it is an indication that they are trying to reach out. Now, you know, how effective is that? Not very, but it's better than nothing. And anything that we can do, Mike, to move the ball and enabling the community to not be disgusted about getting in a discussion of child sexual abuse, especially, we need to do it to break down that taboo. Because they don't understand how devastating it is to be a victim of child abuse, sexual, violent, emotional, or through neglect. It's all bad. It's all terrible. And we'll help people in any way. So that's my comment about the advertising. We can go back to that in a second, Mike. But here's the second idea, second concept. The CDC system is the best thing since sliced bread. Pamela's right. There's several hundred of them around the country. But they're so good, there should be one in every county in the country, which would be thousands and thousands. They are usually housed in a single building, which is child-friendly on the interior in terms of bright colors and flowers and toys to play with and cartoon characters and so forth on the walls and in the waiting rooms and so forth. And the whole family can work through the CDC, the Child CAC, Child Advocacy Center, and engage with whatever they need, medical, child prep for trial. In fact, they're interviewed by forensic psychologists, some of which are officers and some of which are forensic psychologists. They often do it on camera, on video, because more and more courts are allowing that testimony that's taken then to be used in court later. So it avoids traumatizing the child who didn't have to testify again if it's on tape. And then you have family therapy that's often offered in these places, plus plus sort of an ongoing. It's an ongoing oasis, multidisciplinary, as Pamela said, where everybody's trained about child abuse, about trauma prevention, about trauma recovery, and about how to talk to children, relate to children and their families. And so I think it's a hugely important topic for us to bring up every now and then and push for, like I said, one in every county would be great. But if you want, you can look it up just by going to CAC and search that Child Advocacy Center. You'll find there's an association of them, and I believe there'd be, I'm going to guess, 600 or 800 of them around the country, maybe less. Maybe it's less, but there's hundreds, and there should be thousands. But, Mike, I can talk about any of that if you wish for a short period and then give it over to somebody else. Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Yeah,
for having me tonight, and for letting me bring those topics up.
Well, thank you for joining us, Bill, as always. Thank you.
Can I
I'm
say
gonna bring
something
on...
now?
Yes.
Oh, yeah, I was just going to tell you, there's a national chapter of the CAC, and they have a map. If you go under the national CAC.org, there's a map, and you can click on any state in the nation, and it'll tell you all the where all the CACs are. That's all I want to say.
Okay, so it's CAC.org, which is the website, so www.cac.org, and there is a map of all the locations nationally.
Right.
For those that wish to look that up. I just wrote it down myself. I'm going to do my own research on that. Thank you, in the state of Washington. Thank you for that, Pamela. Well, I'm going to bring on Peter again to say another good day, Peter, just to see if you had any questions or comments before the show ends. So, Peter, you're back on.
Good day, Penelope. Good day, Mike. No, I don't know what to say. I feel pretty stupid and dumb that I can't grasp all this information. So I have no comment and no question at this moment, but thank you. But it was great listening to you, Mike.
Well, thank you, Peter. And I don't think that you're intelligent in this area or whatever words you used. I just think that A, you live in a different country than some of the things that we're talking about, but B, I'm learning too. A lot of this is new for me as well. So that's why I love the fact that we archive these shows. So I have to go back and listen to it again just to catch all the things that are being discussed and all the different resources that have been brought up. So as always, Peter, we really appreciate you being on the panel, and thank you. And I'll put you back on mute, and I'm going to bring on Darlene again. If Darlene, you are hopefully, my computer's very slow tonight, back on with Mike.
Hey, I'm sorry, a while ago I had one of my, you know, maybe an ambassador, and when somebody calls in, I've got to take it, you know, so I had to step away briefly, okay? Doing my job.
yeah.
But anyway, I want to thank him for all that he's doing and bringing more awareness also to the show, to somebody that's listening. I hope you pay attention, and you, if you even speculate child abuse, they need to call. If you even speculate it, because you would rather, we would rather, you know, get a false, find out that they're not being abused, than to think that, you know, you might have been their own voice that saved their life.
I so wholeheartedly agree with you, and I've always thought the same thing, Darlene. I mean, what's the worst that can happen? There's nothing really that, you know, to report when the visit is made. But the worst thing that can happen is not to call, and they're happening. So I completely agree with you. And I think a lot of times we have a sense, we know. Sometimes we don't want to acknowledge.
I don't know if the laws have changed since when I was abused or whatever, but I remember the principal called me to the office one day, and he had me sit there for a whole week for an hour each day, right, for the 5 days. And I didn't understand why he called me in there. Well, in 2005, I called him. And I asked him why he did that. He said, I knew you were being abused, and we just needed you to say it. And I was like, I couldn't say it because y'all would have returned me back home to them, and then I would have got beat again, maybe even killed. He said, no, we already had a place for you. I wish there was some other way that that could have worked out, where they could have got me out of there without me saying it. You know what I'm saying? I don't know if it's changed now where they could help the child, you know?
I don't know if I believe it. You know, I think it varies by state. And someone who's probably more, you know, of an expert on this area could respond. But, you know, Mike did bring up something, and I actually wanted to note that Pamela sent me an article written by a NASCA family member on the fact that children, in terms of their rights, are still being treated like they're cattle, right? Children are not property. Children are, people with rights. And you know this, and from my own, you know, experience, you know, when you grow up and you're born to abuse and it's all that you know, I didn't realize I had any rights.
I didn't either, you know.
So
children were just being seen and not heard, you know, basically.
Yes. So, you know,
and
this is why we need. No, go on. This is
finish.
Why we need. Yeah.
So,
no, I'm done.
So to answer that question of Darlene's, you know, it's case specific, and it has changed a great deal. I can't tell you what that same organization might do today that would be different, but it is a shame. I mean, to make the point, it is a shame that they need the child to participate in this. You know, you can't take like a deposition kind of. You can do it on video with the CAC system nowadays in some cases. Otherwise, what Mike was doing was going into court with a child to help them, to assist them, to make sure they got their rights. That's what an ad litem does. And he's absolutely right, and I hope people heard him. The United States is the one country in the world that did not sign the UN paper documents that relate to the rights of children. We didn't sign it. So we're not a part of it. We're in denial here in a lot of ways, and one of those ways is that we live in a crisis. I call it a pandemic. I used to call it a pandemic. and that it's not going to get better unless we, dedicate some skills, some energy, some, you know, money, all of that and more towards defeating this particular pandemic, the pandemic of child abuse. So, but Mike is...
Yeah.
Mike is doing that kind of work in Minnesota and reaching whoever he can in Minnesota. Wouldn't it be great if we had 3 Mikes in Minnesota and 3 in every other state? But we don't. So that's where we are today.
I think at the moment we'll need more than 3 in each state. You know, we'll need 3 in each county or something like that in each state.
But you know the point I'm making. It's the point he made at the very beginning of the show. Legislators are the ones that pass the laws and pass approval of budgets and things like that. And they vote on things they believe their constituencies want. This is not a high priority topic. The only way they find out it's a higher priority than they think it is if people write them. And they do respond to volumes of emails and letters. They do respond to that. So his point about writing your legislature, your representatives and so forth is right on. And I don't expect them to change quickly if they don't feel that there's an urgency. And they simply don't right now.
There's one state, this is really bothersome what I had seen the other day, y'all, and this is a form of child abuse as well. The parents are going ahead and giving their kids away to adopt, and they're legally marrying these kids at 9 years old or whatever, you know. There's one that was 9 and then they had a kid every year, but... product of the people that raped them and they made them marry them, you know? And it's crazy, you know?
Is that still going on?
Yes, in the United States, yes, sir. And they're trying to get it in all 50 states because some of the states do not have a minimum level for you to get married.
I know that's true. I didn't know the age. I know that 11 and 12 were happening now and then, but I thought it was very rare. That's awful.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yes, it is, and we really got to speak out against that because these kids cannot even go to try to get a divorce or anything because they're a child.
Right.
They have no rights.
Right.
They can't go
That's
to abuse
right.
woman shelter because
yeah.
they're not a woman yet. You know, they're a kid still.
What
avenues? There's no avenues
yeah.
for them. It's horrible.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. I just get heated about it. I'm sorry.
Yeah, yeah.
No need to apologize.
It's understandable.
Me,
you know, we talk about how
yeah, they said
children
in Kentucky and other states too, California and different ones.
Well, let's give some time to Mike to finish this concept. But we're saying that, you know, children have rights, but they don't know they have rights. They don't even know that there's such a thing as rights. Never mind what rights are. They don't understand anything. You know, they're blank slates. They don't come with a manual. Mike, can you speak to some of this before we have to end the show? We've got about 10 minutes left.
Darlene, thank you, Darlene.
Yeah, that's the right thing to talk about, too, because when you grow up in a home and you're sexually active and you're taking drugs and you're 9 years old, that's, you know, and then they tell you a little later when you're in a foster home you shouldn't do that. It's really hard. Because you're hardwired to do things that you thought were normal. That was your normal, and you went to school, and then one day you found out that that's making you different. So it hits you on both sides. I mean, it's painful to feel so different, so out of place, and it's impossible, really, to just change behaviors immediately. It doesn't happen. It's back to the importance of a healing model where learning coping skills and being able to come to grips with the issues that you've dealt with. And really, that's where I read a suicide note from a 7-year-old a long time ago, and it could have been written by somebody that was 40. Kids grow up, and it's not right. It's not easy. It's not kind. And so these young kids that don't get a childhood and are forced into, you know, my whole point about the advocacy is that if we catch it young, you know, and we can pull them out of the river when they're 5, 6, and 7, you know, and we're doing it better than we were, but we're also throwing them in the river faster than we were, so we can't catch up. And until we actually, Bill mentioned calling legislators, and you know, if you have a state rep, everybody's got a state rep, and mine knows me, and it should know you. You know, we're citizens in a community. There are 3,006 counties in the nation, and if once a year, that's actually what there's an organization called Safe Passage for Children of Minnesota, and there's about four of them in the country. And they just simply organize an annual trip to the legislature so that you talk to your state rep. They hand you a bill they want passed, or they hand you a speaking thing to articulate to your legislator that you want more crisis nurseries, or you want better mental health services for your kids, or this or that. And so the state rep says, well, yeah, five people showed up today representing other people's children. And then they've been very, very successful. And it's very tempting to try and do more of that. Kids at Risk Action pushes on the public side of things so that we're trying to make our neighbors aware. We're trying to make the people that vote on school money and you know, that we vote on the legislators that want to have crisis nurseries. So the other side of that is to actually go into your, you know, write letters once in a while, send an email once in a while, especially when you see something in the paper that's local that makes you angry. And then you might actually come off as somebody that really is concerned and angry, and by golly, I'm going to come down there and yell at you if you don't do something. And I try to keep it light. It's a serious topic. But we got a long way to go. The good news is this new administration is child-friendly, and they're fighting to put money into systems that are really, really in need of money. And that's about all you can do right now. I don't know. I mean, your organization is grown to include a lot of people in a lot of states. And I want to mention just one last thing that I think it was, I don't know if it was Pamela or Penelope that mentioned that one adult, I know that I was the single adult in one or two children's lives in all those cases I talked about, and I've read about it again and again, that if they can trust one adult, if really at-risk abused children can just find one adult that can create that level of trust again, those are the kids that make it. So for everybody that thinks about it and gets a chance to do it, I really believe that, because the kids in child protection that I've come to know see so many adults, and they're only there for a year or two. And once you've been removed from your home, you really do need a trusted adult in your life. And I'm so grateful that I it really makes me feel good to know that those few kids that I was there for a long time for had happier stories than kids that didn't.
Oh, so absolutely. I'm found you've made such a profound difference. Truly.
Yeah. Absolutely. Well, Mr. Mike, you've done a great job tonight, and thank you for all the information you've given us. I think we need to have some NASCA billboards. That's what I'm thinking. We need to do a campaign to get NASCA billboards out in every
state.
Talk to
me about fundraising. I might be able to help you do that.
Sure. We'd love it.
That's a great idea, Pamela. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Also, Mike, I think you should run for president. I'm just saying.
You got two votes.
I'd help solve a lot of the issues we discussed tonight, right?
Well, can I ask Mike one more question? What can you leave us, Mike, with some positive things that you think all of us can and should do? Like, you know, just
that kind of like a bullet list, just this, and this.
Well, the most positive thing that I can talk about is the ACEs healing model, and that no matter who you're talking to, you know, and I start off with the police. They are trained in a punishment model. And once they understand what it's like to be a traumatized child, we're human beings. And they know they don't want to take care of mental health problems. And they know they don't want to put a 12-year-old in the back of a squad car or taser. You know, but the level of mental health issues that we're dealing with are putting people into these places where it's really impossible for them to do, you know, because they don't have the skills. And so as you talk to people, you know, get to know community leaders and talk to them about the value of the healing model and the value of not throwing kids out of daycare, not throwing kids, you know, not expelling, and that children really are the most valuable things a society can have. I like to quote Pliny the Elder. He says that what we do to our children, they will do to our communities. And he said that 2,000 years ago. And that's what's happening. So if just we talk about what should be happening, and I wish I was more Zen-like, you know, the Zen people are calm and they make you want to do what they want you to do. I'm not that way. I kind of yell at people sometimes. It doesn't work as well as if you're able to calmly explain how well the healing model works. And that once these kids have the coping skills they need to lead a normal life, they will lead a normal life. They will have a normal family. They will pay taxes. They'll be wonderful contributing members of society. But you got to help them get there. That's the only thing I can think of at the moment.
Well, can I ask for prayers for Minnesota? Because there's a lot going on up there. That needs attention, that needs our prayer. The kid that was shot yesterday or the day before was 20 years old, so he was barely out of his childhood. And, you know, it was a, quote, mistake, unquote. They thought they were tasing him, and the female cop shot him. But it spurred, you know, all kinds of reaction, obviously. There's rioting going on. Again, it's the same state where the trial that we're all seeing is going on. 10 miles away, frankly. But to leave you with some hope, there is a group in Minnesota called Empower Survivors, and that's the name of their group. Empower Survivors, like it's one word, .net is their website. And Elizabeth Sullivan is in Stillwater. She is a tremendous advocate for child abuse survivors, and they will be able to help whoever in Minnesota wants assistance. Mm. Mike, you can turn them to her over and over and over. Because she serves that immediate area, but even a broader space.
Cool.
Now that we've been using Zoom.
Thank you.
You're quite welcome.
Well, Bill, thank you for that. Thank you so much, Empower Survivors. I wish to thank our very special guest, Mike T. Mike Chickenen.
Chickenen.
My co-host, Pamela. Bill, Darlene, and Peter, thank you so much for being on the panel. Thank you all for listening. April is Child Abuse Prevention Awareness Month. If you see something, please say something and bless the children. Good night.
Good night, Mike.
Good night now.
Good night, all of you. Thank you. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Blog Talk Radio.